who will talk about what it says on the thing. Allergy advice, this talk has Bayesian content. which I think gives a strong prior belief to predict a good outcome. So over to you.
Thank you.
To provide the data.
Thank you. No pressure there to perform. Before I get started, I want to make particular thanks to three people. Jayantha, who I think many of you know, also works at Roche and asked me if I'd come along to one of these. And foolishly I said yes. And then two other people who are less familiar, I think, with the statistics than maybe some of the audience, but I'm joined by two members of my family. My wife for putting up with the weekend work, because this is forming part of a PhD that I'm doing, and that's why the Imperial College name is up there. She has to ensure that Sundays and things like that are given up. But also my daughter, who's in her first year of undergrad at Warwick, studying maths, and God knows why she wants to travel from Warwick today to Hertfordshire and then back over here. But anyway, thank you for those three people. As I say, this is work in progress. I'm 2 years into a part-time PhD, which may be another 3 or 4 years. And what I like about at least the concept of this discussion is that it's a chance for everybody in the room to critique, to add, to extend, to, you know, whatever discussion would be helpful, because so far, I believe there's some unexplored areas in elicitation and subjective priors. If you'd like to correct me, you'd like to offer advice, input, whether today or afterwards, I'd really like to hear that as we go along. And Ted has already given me the expectation that interruption throughout is absolutely fine with that. There's a natural point at the end where there's a Q&A, but you know, if you want to interrupt partway through, that's absolutely fine. The other thing that I needed to decide was try and guess who would be in the audience. Some of you are going to be bored by the early bit, and I almost make no apologies because I think the other part of the audience may not be. And then there'll be bits later where some of those, it may go a bit over the heads and vice versa. But if you can bear with me, hopefully that some of those questions that come throughout will be valuable to at least most of the people in the room. I just want to post this. I don't know whether anybody remembers this paper from 4 or 5 years ago now, but it's going to become a bit of a theme of this talk. So here's a non-swimmer, wants to wade across the river, so he's going to ask three experts for input on it. So the first one is essentially saying that they think they can get across partway through, but the middle of the river's too deep. The first one says, actually, I think the first part of the river's too deep. And the third expert says, actually, I think it's going to be towards the end of that river's going to be it. So what does this non-swimmer decide to do? Average the advice. Okay. What's he going to do? He's going to take a step in. Oops. Of course, in this case, it might be easy to see what the real question should have been. But I introduced this as a little bit thing. I thought when I read this article, it had some resonance with the idea of asking experts their opinion and making sure that the question is right. So with that kind of motivation, what is it that I'd like to be able to at least provide some structure to the presentation here? I've been working for about a little over 20 years in drug development. I recognise a few faces from people who have also been working in drug development, and for them, certainly it's going to be a recap, and in fact actually I'd like to invite whether you think there's other issues. But I think there are certain challenges well known for drug development. And I've used drug development as opposed to just clinical trials, because I think there's a few different things which can be nuanced out from purely clinical. Yes, clinical trials, but a few other things as well. I felt that at least some discussion of the B word for those people who are perhaps less familiar with some of it, but there really are very, very few formulas in this. And part of that is because, at least in my experience, although some of my clinical colleagues want to and really embrace it, once those equations go up on the screen, the conversation tends to run a little bit dry. So I'm not going to use too many formulas, but there'll be one or two in there. Talk a bit about priors, because that's going to be the focus of this. And then I'd like to highlight for you at least what some of my literature review and early research identified some limitations when eliciting and working with subjective priors. and then give you a worked example that we did recently at Roche, a group of us, and really get your thoughts about the feasibility of the dissertation as well. But please chip in all the way through. Okay, so for those of you who are less familiar with drug development, wanted to put forward a schematic here, which is taken from a paper about 5 years ago now. And if we're thinking about, and this is a US context, in order to get one drug approved, one typically might start screening 5,000 to 10,000 compounds. And if we look at the time frames from screening those compounds through the preclinical research, 3 to 6 years. The IND, for those of you less familiar with US regulations, is the investigational new drug. So the sponsor wishes to conduct a clinical trial in humans. So they make the IND here. So at this stage, we're down to 5 molecules, and we go through the phase 1, 2, and 3 with the potentially volunteers, maybe patients in phase 1, certainly patients in phase 2 and phase 3. And we're talking of these are the order of the size of the trial. So you may have 20 volunteer trials through to the multiple thousands. And then you submit your new drug application, NDA, and hopefully you're at least one of those sponsors that gets a drug approved by the FDA or in Europe, the European Medicines Evaluation Agency. But these are the kind of quantities involved. So lots and lots of compounds, many experiments in order to get one drug. Current estimates, it might be $1 billion, it might be 1.6. I've seen a few different estimates, but they're certainly not the kind of money I get paid. A point to note there, just about these successful ones, this is where the idea of risk, and it's a whole separate debate whether it's, you know, generics company, new molecular entities, new research. For the purposes of today, I'm focusing on new molecular entities, the new drugs, the innovators.
Quick question.
Sure.
On that diagram. It may be that its structure is tightly regulated by FDA or whatever, but it is feasible, for instance, that when you get to phase two in the trial stage, you get adverse information about the drug, which would drop it back behind one which you've already eliminated.
Which would drop it back behind? You mean in terms of bringing another molecule forward?
Yes.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And so many organisations certainly will have backup molecules behind those, so that if this one does drop out, that can come through. Yeah. But I think strictly to answer your question, yeah, you may have already moved one back because you want to do further experiments on it, and then that one comes in behind it.
Yeah.
And then for the one that you've either parked, you might park and just eliminate it totally, or you may bring it back out of the cupboard later.
Yeah. I mean, the evidence as it accumulates is going to have a sort of partial shuffling effect on the order of merit.
Yes. I've got a little slide later that talks about portfolio management. Maybe at that stage we could entertain some further questions. So what are some of these issues that are documented? This is a slide that's been well used by a number of people, but this is the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and it relates to the cost of developing drugs in this time span has gone up, but the number of new drug approvals has gone down. So clearly that equation cannot go on forever if we're truly to have innovative products. So some of the potential solutions, and I'm not suggesting it's all, but some of the models, and Dennis Lendrum and many others have published on this, let's fail faster those that are never going to be molecules that make it into medicines. Let's empty the cupboard and let's restock it with molecules that are likely. On the other hand, these likely ones, how can we progress them faster? So this was a paper published last year that did some further analysis of it and trying to look at when and why drugs are failing. In this particular paper, it was highlighting that if we look at phase three, we're actually getting worse. These are molecules that where we used to be having an attrition rate around about the 20% mark in phase 3 in 1990, and we're now up to 50% failure rate in phase 3. And if one is thinking, you're failing these at the most expensive time of developing it, what could be some of the issues? You know, again, this is an unsustainable this does keep increasing. So we need to potentially, I'm not saying it's the only solution, but potentially do a better job of finding these failures in phase one and two, and it starts to be a focus today. There are other solutions, and that's maybe talks for another time, but...
Yeah, I think, again, as time passes, for instance, in 2004, a candidate drug may be in competition with a drug that was already in place since 1990 for the same condition.
Yes.
And people have been trying to do better for the 1991 for 15 years.
Yeah.
So if the more you try to compete with an established product, the more you're going to fail.
One could say that, but I think the other potential side of that coin is that if there's a drug that's been not yet licensed, but been long development time, one might question whether there's properties about that molecule in itself.
But there's a sort of obvious explanation for the increasing failure rate.
It's certainly one.
As time passes, you have more and more drugs already approved
for
various conditions, and therefore new attempts to compete with those are more likely to fail.
Yeah. And so the mechanisms of actions there can be important as well. So if one looks at what some of those challenges are, where might you hypothesise there are some opportunities to actually improve that? So I'm most focused here today around the new drugs or the new molecular entities here. This was something that I actually only picked up fairly recently, so if you know this paper better than me, by all means comment on it. But what Lichtenberg was publishing was documenting that human lifespan had gone up by 2 years from 82 to 2001, and did some analyses that proposed that at least 40% of that was increased due purely to the new drugs. Clearly there's other reasons why lifespan might have increased in that period, but in his analysis documented or projected that 40% of that was due to the new molecular entities. So here we have on the one hand the potential of new molecular entities to solve diseases and move things on and increase human life, but that we're seeing fewer of them improved and the costs going up. How are we going to be able to balance some of these equations? Another factor that potentially one could look at as a way to improve the way that we develop drugs, and I don't apologize for the size of this, I use this as a schematic to represent that when we're working with new biology, we may not understand that biology. You know, it may be biology that's emerging as our understanding of the molecules are. So the importance of experimental design and redesign might be playing alongside each other. We're not talking about an area necessarily that we fully understand the biology when we're doing either the preclinical or the early development experiments there. So if we do find ourselves in a situation where we're working with new molecules, where we're working with a biology that's less well understood, well, we either just put up with it and complain, or, and this is one of the things that might be a discussion point, at least let's make it transparent to the people who are evaluating and helping design and helping to run this experiment. Let's just quantify this uncertainty rather than just saying it's nothing we can do. Let's quantify it. So I think this is my final slide on some areas for improvement. And I just wanted to bring out one of the guidances, one of the regulations that we follow with the International Conference of Harmonisation, topic E4. It talks about the dose response. So I mention this because we are required, and it's where statisticians do play a big part, about knowledge of the relationships. This is what we generally do in phase two. We're looking to identify what the therapeutic window is. That's this part in here where we have the opportunity to choose the right dose that maximises efficacy but without too much toxicity kicking in. So again, this is one option as to why phase two is an area to look to improve the way that we are developing our molecules, reducing failures. One of the common things, at least I've seen, but if you see it differently, let's potentially talk about that, is that many teams can get pressured to only do two studies in phase two. I've seen a number of programs where potentially only one phase two study, and it's the be-all and end-all of phase two. But if one looks at the classic, where proof of concept is the first time in patients, for example, and we want to know, does this molecule show some promise of activity? We may not pick the right dose. In fact, very often the proof of concept is just whacking the highest dose possible to show that we've got some kind of activity. And then we do a dose response to try and tease out these relationships. If we don't get these things right, or if we do things in a perhaps suboptimal way, maybe our phase two is not going to be so good. So then phase three, we end up finding the failures. So what is a typical phase two approach? And you know, I have to pick one, and you know, how long's a piece of string? But let's say, for example, a typical phase two run in a frequentist fashion. Could other things like Bayesian work? Well, why might one look to other approaches like Bayesian? Well, so one of the things that we have to do for dose response study, first of all, is we've got to estimate, even before we run the trial, some kind of shape. So is the dose response going to look like this? Is it going to be like this? Is it going to be sigmoidal? Is it going to be a linear straight line? We clearly have to estimate that even before we run the study. And what are we going to do? Well, in the normal frequentist fashion, we're going to use these kind of confidence intervals, p-values, and estimate the parameters of that curve. So by way of example, really just, I guess, to labour the point, one might be thinking, well, if you run a phase two study and you are using the frequentist, you might say, this might be your conclusion. You know, 75 milligram dose reduces symptoms against placebo with the difference of 15 units, P equals, confidence interval equals. But what's one of the limitations? Well, in the frequentist fashion, as I'm sure everybody's very familiar, arguably doesn't give you the answer to the question that the clinician really wants. It's the probability of seeing the data, given there's actually nothing going on with this molecule. Whereas really what the clinician is interested in is they want probabilities about the parameters of interest. The other thing that I just highlighted on this slide is this assumption that we're getting the shape right in our guess even before we set up the study. So these are some of the things that one can argue that we can improve phase two. Well, what might we see if we do run the traditional phase two? We might get some undesirable outcomes. For instance, and I've highlighted here, if we think we know the shape of the curve, but we end up allocating everybody to points on the curve that are down here, clearly we've put too many on the low dose. And then similarly, one might say that you have put them on the high dose and you don't really estimate the shape of this curve properly. Frequent things, certainly I've seen, but I have seen other variations, is where you actually allocate the same number of patients to every single dose in here. Maybe that's not optimal in a phase two. Maybe it is sometimes, but you know what I'm saying, this is maybe a classical way. So what happens to the molecule in these situations? Well, we might throw a very decent molecule that could be a real medicine for the benefit of patients, and we may declare failure and stop development of that molecule. On the other hand, there may be a pressure to say, oh, we got it wrong, can we rerun it again? And you have to redo the trial. It takes longer, it takes more expense, and maybe we get the right answer second time round. Okay, but perhaps we could do better with our experimental design first time round. Something else that's not always highlighted, but certainly I think the statisticians we probably feel very comfortable with, is if we've got poor estimation and we haven't got good estimates out of the phase two, maybe our phase three studies are overpowered or underpowered, and therefore maybe some of the reasons for failure in phase three are because we did our phase two in a suboptimal way. It can get a bit depressing seeing all these problems, can't it? And you think, what are you going to do about it? Well, hopefully, at least within the next 5 or 10 minutes, I can start to say what some of the hopes are around it as well. So let's just have a very, very brief review of the Bayesian methods and why one might want to do it. You know, there's a huge literature out there. That my talk is not about covering this literature. You've seen it before, most of you, but I just put it up there for some of the benefits. I've already spoken about the Bayesian methodology answers the question the clinicians want. We can do repeated analysis without taking penalties on our inferences if we desire and we set the experiment up. But also, I think something there which obviously David Spiegelhalter has commented on, it really does provide this framework. We can continually learn. So maybe phase one, maybe phase two, where we're learning about the drug, maybe we're learning about the biology, we can use the Bayesian framework for continual updating. This really is labouring a point. There may be nobody in the room that needs this labour, but I certainly, speaking with non-statisticians, have found the paper by Don Barry to be very readable. And okay, this may be done in the context of flipping a coin, but I think one could easily see this in the context of, you know, an adverse event or seeing a response to a treatment here, where we might have no idea, first of all, whether the response rate on this molecule is anything between 0 and 1. And so we get the first patient in and we get a success. And as Don Barry's paper shows, this is what the posterior looks like. And then we get another success, and then the posterior starts to look like that. And now we get a patient in with a failure, and the distribution is starting to look a little bit different. And then through repeated successes and failures, we can obviously build up the 10 patients worth and come out with our final posterior. And then we can even look at the predictive probabilities if we get a success or failure. As I say, this is a vehicle that I've used in the past, maybe you've used this one or other ones, to think about the attractiveness or the appeal of the Bayesian framework. But what about in practice? So yes, I have done literature review. Is it as comprehensive as every single literature review that's ever been done on Bayesian methods? No. Have you got some great papers? Tell me about them. I'll carry and add it to mine. But at least I would argue that it's been fairly limited. If you're familiar with a paper by Sung, it's published that when one looks at the Bayesian trials in the clinical trial literature that were prospectively designed with Bayesian as the primary, so not a retrospective one, but the prospective one, he documents only 40 published clinical trials. One might wonder why that's the case. Is it because they're lousy and nobody wants to use them, or is it because there are some reasons that we can find out? Clearly, the dominance of the frequentist methods has, and the acceptance within journals has something to play with it, but also, you know, I'm familiar, maybe you too as well, that generally there's regulatory conservatism. One could question why. You know, in phase three, maybe absolutely the frequentist has its place, but in my experience I've seen that then backtrack into phase two and phase one, and people think it's the only thing that regulators will do. But I think one could argue that that's a sponsor risk to take in phase one and phase two if it wants it to. I don't know, maybe at this point I'll ask the open question. Are there other reasons why we haven't seen more than 40 published?
Yes, I think there is. And one of them is that there's very rarely any prior evidence intelligently used. Many of the examples I see of people trying to use Bayesian methods, they just start off with very bright because they haven't got anything else. And you then ask the question, well, why are we using this approach when we haven't got anything?
Yeah.
And I think that's why the subject you're talking about, the elicitation of priors, is perhaps a way of getting in there where you provide something that wouldn't use it.
Yeah. Which is, I guess, getting to, and particularly for people who are less familiar, the idea that you can formulate frequencies through using a Bayesian if they're non-informative. But yeah, the point being there may be other parts of the Bayesian paradigm that, like the subjective or the informative private can help.
So let's make a slightly counterpoint. I suggest virtually every study we run has got prior,
because we put placebo in our studies, and we put placebo in a lot of all our studies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an immediate source of prior for those, which we do use. Why they don't get published is potentially because the journals, is that it's easy to get something published in Quintus, and you don't want to go through the heartache of trying to educate them on something. This we do it for our internal mm-hmm. purposes mainly. And the regulatory thing is a complete myth, because up to phase two they don't care.
Mm.
I mean, as long as it's ethical, safe, and they can convince that you're getting information from your study that's valuable, which we've never had any problems with mm-hmm. doing that with a Bayesian approach. There's no problem.
Yeah, and I think many people do share that view that there is. It's a myth, I think, to use that phrase. However, it's a myth that somebody needs to overcome, or you know, evangelists.
We've gone to regulators and they've okayed it. Yeah. And it's not just placebo. We often use standard of care in our studies, and there's tons of data on standard of care as well.
Yeah.
So there's no reason why it's not used.
So Well, let's see by the end of the talk whether there's any other ideas come through as well.
But if the regulators are okay with Bayesian approach, that means they're not concerned about type 1 error rate, because as soon as you want a type 1 error rate, you're a frequentist. And my impression is that we're told by everyone that regulators really do care about type 1 error rates.
So the early stage, it's the sponsor, is, and you know, one can look at the frequentist properties of Bayesian designs, and some people do that, and that's in some sense pandering to that, but yes, the regulators would want to see those.
The only people that we get questions from are statisticians in the regulatory organisation, and often when we go to the meetings, no one else asks.
This is good discussion. So why might we change? Is this an uphill battle for either for some of these reasons, like, you know, it's the statistician? Well, Munoz, in similar papers to the earlier ones that I've presented in there, said, and it was his phrase, the model is broken. So, you know, 50 years thinking about how much, I don't know, the car industry's moved forward. Think how much the computing industry has moved forward. How much further has drug development moved forward in 50 years?
Just very quick question. Model is broken. Which one?
The current paradigm of phase one, phase two, phase three. Thanks for that. So where are some of the greatest opportunities? And if anybody has got laser vision good enough to read that font, I want to know where you got your eyes done. The reason why I've included this is to talk about the concept which is slightly different from clinical trials, which is about general drug development or portfolio management. I work for Roche, other companies have published their own pipeline, but I just took a screen grab of every single molecule that's currently going through the Roche pipeline and made it fit onto one slide. That's an awful lot of projects. And these are projects, so you have multiple clinical trials within the projects, multiple experiments within them. I think we could potentially argue, or I'd like to argue, that this is a portfolio management issue for which there are competing resources and competing priorities. And maybe expecting 100% of these to get through, well, certainly we know that's not right, because classically only 90% of them, only 10% will get through the human. Yeah, 90% can get through.
Are you sure you're allowed to show us that slide?
Yeah, that was you know, this is potentially something where we have internal, for example, Roche, but you know, your organisation may have internal subjective expert opinion about the likelihood of successes of some of these. Maybe it's the biology, maybe it's the molecules that are ahead of it. But there's one potential opportunity that we can improve on the drug development model. Stephen Senn and colleagues in the RSS Working Party have explicitly said, this was obviously after the Tegenero incident, that incorporating vague information is something that should be strongly considered. And like Phil said, you know, we do have information on many of these when we actually set these up. And individual prior dissertation is mentioned there. So if we are working with new molecular entities where the biology may not be well understood, and we want to document that uncertainty, again, let's just reduce the uncertainty, let's use the expert opinion potentially to make that transparent so that we can take decisions that might help the portfolio. So a very small bit on priors, the well-known Bayesian formulation here with theta being our quantity of interest and the prior on theta is what I've just highlighted up there. The reason why I'm going to show you this is just because, I guess, to come back to Peter's point about the use of non-informative priors, because they are the most often seen way that the Bayesians will approach various other names, objective. People certainly have criticised that term, but reference prior. And the basic outcome being is we want to let the data dominate itself. And one could do a phase three using a non-informative prior, let the data dominate, but yeah, I think you had a question why you do set the Bayesian up just to do a frequentist. I show this picture because I really, really like this image, taken from a book by William Ball Bolstad from one of the New Zealand universities, I think it's Waikiko, I think it is. It's a book that was published in 2010. The reason why I like it is for talking with non-statisticians. You put that up there, and in my experience, that's, as I say, the eyes kind of sort of glaze over. If I can talk you through what the image is there, see whether you think this is something that your non-statistical colleagues might like. So it's a three-dimensional image of which theta, the parameter of interest, maybe it's, I don't know, a reduction in blood pressure, maybe it's a survival endpoint, maybe it's a response rate, but theta is in this, and Bolstad calls it the inference dimension. He then says in the observation or the sample space dimension, the y's, one can think of a likelihood made up of this surface. You know, you fix theta, that's what it looks like. You fix theta, that's what it looks like. And then you take the likelihood across here. Why do I like this? Because I feel that when one sees this, if you start with a non-informative prior, in other words, theta could be any particular value, and you multiply it by the likelihood, that's what's going on here, then your posterior is going to have exactly the same shape, so all you're doing is going down. So it's no surprise that this gives you, in a different way, but the inferences, because you're just taking the mode at the observed value of the y. So the mode is the maximum likelihood estimate in there. And I'll just go on a little bit later to show you how Bolstad also explains when you're using the formative prior. And again, you know, as mathematicians, we're familiar with this. The non-mathematicians may feel more comfortable understanding what's going on. And there's various theories, uses of why people use these non-informatives. I'm not going to discuss them further here because we'll be here all night and there's maybe snow on the way. So what about potentially then using the informative or the subjective priors? I think using the image that Bolstad has, in my view, very nicely says that, well, if I'm willing to put some kind of informative prior on it, I can immediately see that the shape of my posterior is going to be different. This is more like a hill or a saddle shape in here. And so my inferences will be different in that case. Just a thing on nomenclature here. So if I think about the general term informative, this could be because it's through data, and it's, you know, a mathematical algorithm. I have to do an experiment, I get data out, it's informing my next prior. Most of my talk is around the use of subjective priors, where I'm not just using data, but maybe some expert opinion as well. So I just differentiate those two. So if you like, subjective is one possible way to make an informative prior.
Bit of a technicality which you may not want to get involved in, but what is meant by a non-informative prior can be interpreted in more than one way.
Mm-hmm.
One interpretation is, for instance, that if you're looking for mean value, which might be from minus infinity uniform distribution,
yeah,
informative, or for a positive parameter, log of that uniform. That's sort of, as it were, plucked from the air, really. Not invariant under transformation, not a parameter.
Yeah.
The alternative approach is when you put in a statistical model, a probability outcome depending on parameter, the behavior of that model with respect to variation of the parameter gives you information in a certain sense. And you can then use that behavior to select a prior which is, as it were, either non-informative or minimally informative with respect to that class of models.
Okay. So, is that... just to make sure that I'm either linking it or I've admitted it. Which I...
Well, I'm just putting this up as a sort of a technical point to do with non-informative priors.
Yeah.
What that means depends upon which way you look at the problem.
The problem, yes. Yes.
And you can have exactly the same problem and get different non-informative priors depending on which way you look at it.
Yes. But for the rest of this talk, certainly I'm interested in the informative situation,
yeah.
but the point's well taken. Tony Hagen introduced in, I think it's 2004, or he's reminded these two quantities in here about aleatory and epistemic. I introduced it because, or rather I introduced Tony Hagen's definition because I feel it's useful that when we come to the expert incitation, that we fully understand what the expert is being asked. Ideally, and I'll walk through it, we're interested from a statistical point of view of this thing called epistemic. It's some lack of knowledge about a parameter. But we have to recognise that potentially that's very hard for an expert to tease out between the two. And people, you know, Tony Hagen and others have done the work on that. I'd be interested by the end for people to conjecture on why I chose Hemel Hempstead in there, but we'll leave that to the end. So in Tony O'Hagan's and colleagues' book in 2006, he brings this out further and talks about, well, let's suppose we're doing FEV1, so forced expiratory volume in 1 second, maybe we're measuring in asthma patients. We might choose to set up a model, mu being the grand mean, alpha being the effect of the drug, and then we've got between and within patient variability. And what he's saying is that in this configuration, the aletry refers to the P and E parameters, and the other four are the epistemic. And this is what we're really interested in when we're talking to the experts and we're running our experiments and getting tighter, better and better information. So either we can ask the expert to ignore the aletry, or we can do some measures which test whether they're really giving us about the aletry or not. Samantha Choi, who works in the ecology field, published, many people, as probably you know, published on this. The reason why I wanted to put the 2009 paper, because I thought it was a nice summary of general methods of elicitation. Oh, and by the way, there's a whole lot of references in the back. I'm going to go through to the slides and pull the references off that as well. But generally, what the facilitator will do, quite often the recommendation is that the statistician is that facilitator, by the way. So if you're looking for a job and you're not happy with your current one, you're getting into some of this maybe offer your way out the credit crunch. So the facilitator is then eliciting the number of judgments from one or more experts, chooses the distribution to fit to the expert's judgments, and then does some feedback loop to check what the quantities that have been elicited actually make sense in a consistent, coherent, valid, etc. Some of the methods that have been published, and I'll give you some examples in the next slide, I think it is, the roulette or the chips and bin method, sometimes called chips and bin. And then these other methods have been fairly popular in the literature, percentile method that talks about how to elicit from experts. Yes, Tim?
In the elicitation from experts, say you have two or more experts.
Yes.
What happens if you feed the distribution from one expert back to another expert?
Yeah.
What happens? They happen not to agree with each other.
Ah, excellent question. I think you've prompted one of my slides that's coming up.
Okay.
If I don't answer it there, let's cover it again. But yes, multiple experts not agreeing could very well be an issue there. So here's some examples. Sheila Goraz was introduced this roulette method, and Doug Arrington and colleagues used it, including my current supervisor here, Deborah Ashby, one of the co-authors, so that example there. Samantha Choi and colleagues have published an add-on for WinBugs. Here's a screenshot taken. This is their add-on, which will help you form, and if necessary, using this tool when you're speaking with the experts. But I'm going to speak about something else, which is Jeremy Oakley and Tony O'Hagan of the Sheffield. They're on version 2 of their Sheffield Elicitation Framework, what SHELF stands for. And they publish not only a form that you can use, but also an R package, which I actually have got running in the background if there's people or labels or want to see it later or there's time to do it. But there are people who've taken frameworks, either the ones that Samantha Choi has documented or other ones, and then shown how you can use some of these frameworks to do the elicitation. However, what I have pretty much picked up is that the validation for these intuitive methods is actually pretty sparse. In fact, I believe that's the only paper that exists about the validation of some of these. And I'll go on and give that example, but if you know others, I need to know about it, otherwise my PhD is going to go nowhere. But so far, this is the only one that I've found. So this is where we take the expert opinion and maybe tell us what happens if you have multiple and we need to form a single prior. At the moment, I'll just say form a single prior. You could have sceptical and enthusiastic and there's a whole issue itself, but let's suppose we only want one prior. Generally, we fall into two classes, the mathematical aggregation classes, which are, again, subdivided into what's called the linear or the logarithmic pool. If it's linear pooling, it kind of says, well, if the blue is expert one and the green is expert two, then a linear combination gives weight where any of the experts think there is a belief. Whereas the logarithmic pool gives most weight where the experts agree. And there's been publications, Kevin McConway, I think, is at the Open University, has said you can't have your cake and eat it. With these mathematical approaches, if you choose the linear or the logarithmic, you cannot have both properties satisfied that you have it where any or both investigated. But that's the mathematical. I'm going to spend less time in that there. I'm going to spend more time on what falls into this behavioural aggregation. And I think this is what's also come back to Ted's point about you can have many experts and they might disagree, and there's techniques, Delphi and there's various other ones that you could get models for how to, the facilitator, and here's your nice friendly statistician in blue and your experts in white, to form those pooled opinions, if you like. Need to be aware of some of what's perhaps more the psychology literature around group dynamics. And being too confident, I think it's my next slide that I show what some of the issues of those are. So the first of which is about overconfidence, and what the experts, at least in the literature, are showing is that the tails of the distribution are very often poorly estimated, or at least the experts are poor at giving their judgment in the tails. One of the things that I'm interested in, I've not spent a lot of time yet, but I will and I need to, is understanding if there are some parameters for which maybe it's okay that the tails aren't. You know, maybe there's something, if I'm interested in, it's around some sense of distribution. I don't know, I haven't done enough work, but if you've got some thoughts around that, that you think that might be a problem that's theoretical but not practical, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Something that's called the dictator effect. I don't think that term probably needs to go into much explanation, but I'm sure we've all been in meetings where there tends to be one person who tends to hog it. You've probably got your own favourite meeting. There are various aspects of bias that one needs to be aware of. If you know, is your prior representative? Availability, you know, experts very often, you know, I count myself in it, what's the weather like tomorrow? It's probably going to snow. Why? Because it's very cold today. Yeah, but what's it normally like? The most recent events can have a bearing. This anchoring is something that, at least from what my reading of the literature, so the facilitator needs to guard against. You know, you say to somebody, so what do you think the chance of this drug working is? Or what's the chance of an adverse event? Is it 20%? Oh, 20%. And people anchor on the 20%. That's that phenomenon in there. The stakes of the expert, Joe Cadena has spoken about this. And, you know, really, if you've got an investigator you're asking and is running your trial, could one criticise whether that's an appropriate expert? So nearly all of, certainly of the more recent papers around this, speak about the using a protocol and being very transparent about what you're doing. Mary Kinn has published in the GRSS, based on her PhD about 5 years ago. She didn't use a medical example, but I've transferred it into this one. One could ask an expert, if you've got new asthma therapy, what's your best guess at the mean number of exacerbations? Well, one could reformulate it. I'll let you read that. I'll go silent for a change. You might have your own thoughts as to which is a more appropriate question, but as a facilitator, as maybe somebody involved with designing an experiment, these could be the kind of choices that you have to make. So I think being aware of what at least some of the literature shows, the actual example that I think was drawn on this work was about baseball players and about where would you put so-and-so baseball player in the top 20.
interesting ambiguity in both versions of that question. They are asked as, without making any assumptions as to what one knows about asthma.
So one would hope that one's talking to a physician, maybe a pharmacologist, a drug safety medic, who knows about the condition.
Yeah.
But there are those definitions of what an expert is. I think that is what is an expert. I've seen one view is that anybody with an opinion, person on another 10 buses.
Yeah. I mean, my answer to part two would be expected physician. I think 10.5. Because as far as I know, they're all random. They're exchangeable.
Exchangeable, yeah.
You see, you should get...
But if I knew something about asthma, then the 0.25 exacerbations per year might tell me something about patient X.
Yeah.
If you could enlist, if this elicitation was perfect, you'd gather that by the range, because you'd give a range of 1 to 20, or half to 20, 19, whatever. Whereas an expert would give a tighter range.
If you could do it perfectly.
So in my basic understanding of severe exacerbations for asthma, yeah, two exacerbations is quite a lot for a clinical trial to be able to observe. But anyway, yeah, you know, what is an expert? We could certainly get into a discussion around that. What are some of the potential criticisms of this? Well, we've got an anchor on 0.25. Is that going to affect the way the expert? How are we accounting for aleatory uncertainty? Well, here, we've explicitly said it's 20 patients. Would the expert have given the same opinion if it was 100? Now, ultimately, we might be able to put, you know, an infinite number of patients, and then we would get that epistemic uncertainty. I would like to argue, and you can tell me, particularly those of you who are working heavily in clinical trials, whether it would be helpful for a range of questions that would help. Why? So that we could maybe push a number of these publications and clinical trials and get familiarity, get the feasibility higher. Feel free to disagree. This point about lack of validated evidence, the chart trials, Max Palmer colleagues, this Johnson et al., that's the paper there, has put forward quite a heavy criticism saying that, yes, a lot of these do have intuitive appeal, and they come from very good basis, theoretically, but they have not followed traditional measurement science approaches. And he went away and then did a further publication in 2010, and another one in scleroderma, if I can say that right, in 2011, where he'd argue that now, in the condition of scleroderma, it's an autoimmune disease, that chips and pins is a validated method. But where do we stand in other diseases with other tools? So I think, and this is something that I'm interested in doing as part of my research work, is that we need some more testing in that before routine use can be. If Sung and et al. Was saying that there were only 40 published trials, of which I've only been able to find 20 of those that have used subjective priors, we put that in context of 25,000 studies running in the USA. This is a pretty small literature in which to base it. So I believe that we do need some more testing of these frameworks. What about the feasibility? You know, this is not something that's just, at least in my view, about the validity of it, but can we do it? You know, these experts, where do they exist? Do they all exist in one room, in one place, on one day, ready for our experiment? Well, something that we wanted to do within the UK statistics group of Roche, through a series of seminars that we do, is actually increase... And perhaps to address Phil's point, very often it's the statistician who's the barrier. And so we have a group of, I think it's about 30 statisticians now in Welland Garden City. And we put on a seminar and we invited medical experts to be those experts. And we ran to see how feasible it was. We had this hypothetical molecule for ankylosing spondylitis. Again, it's an autoimmune disease. And typically one would use this endpoint called the ASAS-20. Is how it's defined. And we want to be able to say, well, we've got information about Rogood from other indications. Maybe it's RA, maybe it's another scleroderma, I must pick another disease, I'll give this talk again. Is it feasible to ask the experts about it? And so we had these potential questions, a little bit similar to how you saw it on that slide about Mary Finn's work. And we had to make a decision. You know, which question will we be asking the experts? Is it estimate the proportion achieving ASAS-20? Suppose we're doing 40 patients for 14 weeks. How many of these would... Well, what happens if we're studying 400 for 14 weeks? And make choices. Ultimately, this was the definition we used. Much, much longer, but we felt was a very tight question, and we wanted to test the feasibility of it. So we decided to use the Sheffield Elicitation Framework, wrote the protocol for it, that was the date it was conducted. The experts were given this information beforehand. We chose experts with medical backgrounds, pharmacology background. We had a statistician in there, drug safety scientist in there as well. We gave three publications for them to read so they would have a consistent domain in there, with the idea of seeing whether it was feasible. And the way that we did it initially, because it was a little bit of a training aid for the statisticians as well, is that we assigned one expert to a table and a group of statisticians sat around observing. And we asked that expert, without conferring to the other experts in the room, create your distribution. What do you think? And I'm in the process of actually writing that up. And I hope to be able to tease out and eventually, if it's accepted, to publish it wider, along with my colleagues as well. But the idea being is, what did we learn about the feasibility of working with experts and creating their distribution? What about the exercise of then getting those experts to agree on a single prior afterwards? And what we did to use it was actually run this software here, the Sheffield Elicitation plugin, which, as I say, I've got on the laptop if people want to see it afterwards. But essentially what you're doing is you're clicking a plus button each time you want to build part of your histogram.
Interesting social situation. You've got a group of experts sitting around the table.
Initially, it's one expert at a table,
yes.
And the statisticians were observing to get familiar with this framework.
Okay, so there's just one expert.
Yeah, and then elsewhere there's an expert at a different table.
Okay, yeah, so the experts in no sense communicate with each other.
The experts, was not allowed to communicate with expert two, or expert three, or expert four.
And the statisticians just sit there soaking it up.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
We didn't actually invite them, and it was our choice, but we invite them, prompt your expert for what they're doing. You know, how easy is it to place that middle, that first point? What's it like to work out what the tails are? All designed to see about the feasibility of this, and also increase awareness in the statistical community. So I'm getting towards the end, and I think, you know, this certainly time to invite further discussion, but I'd like to suggest to you that I made a bit of a case for where Bayesian approaches might work. Good portfolio management with probability of success of the molecules that maybe a number of them in company or an organization's portfolio. I'd argue that the Bayesian paradigm itself allows us to cope at least with where the biology may be progressing at the same rate as our understanding of the molecule, by just putting uncertainty through a prior on that. We have lots of information, whether it's, you know, from an adult because you're moving into a pediatric population, or, you know, healthy volunteers, interpatients, that we can use the Bayesian framework for that. But at least one issue that I've highlighted today is about the validity of some of these methods to form it. I don't think they're insurmountable, but that's a thing. You know, you please challenge that. And I would argue that if you do decide to proceed, you need to make sure that the question format takes account. But what does that then lead you with? Well, I would say that, you know, we have some understanding of the biology. Our medical colleagues can help us with that. We can understand how that's going to help. We may have some data which we can bring to that. We can also have our experimental design set up. And this final piece that I'm most focused on today is around bringing in some subjective expert opinion, because not all of this data will be in the public domain necessarily, and it may be some experiment for which an expert can comment. But the idea being is to have a transparent framework to build one or more priors, maybe skeptical, maybe enthusiastic. You can make your own choices. But the idea being is that once you've got the prior, combine it with your likelihood and get your posterior. And what will that allow you to do? Well, answer the questions that are of interest. Those molecules that you really shouldn't be pushing forward, don't. Those ones that you believe should be medicines, keep growing that knowledge and eventually hopefully get a license for it. Some acknowledgements there. My PhD work is sponsored by Roche. Deborah Ashby and Martin Wilkins at Imperial, and Simon Day, who a number of you may know from former MHRA, now at Roche Products, plus also my colleagues who helped to organise the Bayesian seminars there, representing these disciplines. I'm not saying these are the only disciplines that we could have chosen from, but they seem to be representative of experts in drug development for the clinical trials. So finally, this is where I'll close and then open it up to questions here. I'd like to think that the Bayesian methodology using subjective priors does offer you a way that you can address both under or over optimism, and certainly I've seen over optimism, and perhaps you have too, about early results. But I bet there's people in the room who are maybe just not ready to take that leap yet, and I've used this quote when I've given this talk in a variety of formats before, and it may be the last time I use it. I think people are getting sick of it now, but I'll maybe use it for one last time. Questions?
First of all, thank you.
That is, you're trying to measure uncertainty, but you're introducing another level of uncertainty because you don't know whether what you're getting from these experts is unbiased or not, whether they're sufficiently heterogeneous or not. And if you are wrong, if they are on average wrong, when you put them together, however you combine this information, you might actually be in a worse situation than if you hadn't done anything at all.
Yeah.
And to not be able to take account of that level of uncertainty just seems to mean you've just got an ever-increasing problem to solve.
So my initial response, but invite other ones as well, because this is a description of my initial response, is yes, I agree about you adding a level of uncertainty. The way that I propose that could be addressed, maybe not completely, but could be addressed, is by actually forming, if you like, the priors at the ends of the spectrum. So if you've got the most sceptical prior that you could possibly do, and you can either simulate or through other ways, show that combining that sceptical prior with the likelihood still leads you to take a decision that is, in some sense, sceptical, but it allows the molecule to go forward or be killed, then yes, you could still make a decision, and it's probably at the most sceptical end of that decision. But it doesn't rule out uncertainty, it just says that we can take a decision using subjective information in the most sceptical way. I don't know, I mean, I invite other comments, but...
A related view that, in a way, on the one hand, come to dislike the idea of the Bayesian analysis because you've then got this final presentation of the experiment which is reflecting what you knew or believed before rather than just telling you what was in the experiment. I mean, in the obvious case, if you had a very strong prior, then what you reported would be entirely dominated by that prior, which is surely what people want from you is the results of the experiment, and they will add the context. But to me, I think that still leaves a role for Bayesian thinking, which was encapsulated in your contour plot, that you can actually with a uniform prior, you can present nothing but the results of the experiment, but you can present them in Bayesian terms. So a confidence interval now means what everyone always thought a confidence interval meant, namely that there is that probability that the true value lies in that range. A p-value, one-tailed p-value, means what everybody always thought it meant, well, no matter how many times you tried to tell them it meant something different, namely that the probability of the true value being beyond that was that low. So it has a value as a way of communicating, not as a way of adding...
I suppose one thing that I haven't thought about, but it at least reminds me of, is that one can at least document how much borrowed strength from those, through the effective sample size methodology or other methods of quantifying how much borrowed strength. And if you want zero borrowed strength, as you say, that just comes back to that, non-informative. But if one wishes to say, well, we know something about this molecule, this disease, and we're willing to say it's 20 patients worth or 10 patients worth, then at least we have a framework for living in.
Well, the question you just raised, what it boils down to at rock bottom is that a Bayesian posterior distribution on a continuous variable is a distribution. Therefore, you can calculate the probability belonging to an interval of, say, twice the length versus half the length. Whereas in the frequentist domain, give or take a bit, but you're fundamentally working with something you've got to the likelihood function. That is a point function, and it is not a distribution. In its first instance, it's meaningless to integrate it over an interval. The Bayesian mechanism is effectively a method of deriving a distribution from a point-defined function. So, different syntax, if you like. You're changing the language. Whether the means that you introduce to do that is justified, I think, is what underlies your questions. Mm-hmm. But as a general question, it is not obvious that it is justifiable to do it.
So
you have to, in some sense, verify that it's justifiable.
We've got a question here.
Sorry.
Well, it's a comment, really. So I'd like to put up a strong case for why it's important to use informative priors as opposed to even to do Bayesian with flat priors. And so I think the last one about determining p-values as a Bayesian probability, which numerically is true if you put a flat prior, but I would suggest that particularly in the situation you're talking here, which is early clinical studies, a flat prior is ridiculously optimistic because it's saying you've got a good chance of a huge effect, whereas we know there's a very good chance you've got a very small effect. And it's not very difficult, if you go through some calculations, to get some rather ridiculous answers if you interpret p-values as Bayesian probabilities, and that all comes down to the fact that prior is inappropriate. And the other point about if the experts are incorrect, but those are the people who make decisions, so we've got a choice. We can either try to help formalise that process by which the decisions are made, or we can say, offer them the more standard summaries of the data and let them try and figure out some ad hoc method of applying their beliefs to the data, which will probably come down to interpreting p-values incorrectly.
Case for transparency.
I agree, and so I think that the idea of sensitivity you raised, I think, is the way we must go. We've been circling around this idea of how much effort to put into elicitation, and we've done some of this over the last two or three years at Pfizer. And in the context of these early areas, I'm less sure that we get much out of putting a lot of effort into that. We need to get in the ballpark, but I think it's to getting those range of priors and understanding, are we sensitive to that? The question then is, if you are sensitive, what do you do? Because ultimately you've got to make a decision. So I think it's important to then, it is important to have some idea of what you, where your best prior is, if you like. Because if you try to do it afterwards, it's impossible. No. Because all the objectivity, you know, once the data's in front of you, it's very difficult to get objective information. So just to summarise, I don't see what the alternative is. If we want Bayesian answers, we've got to have Bayesian priors. And if we don't want Bayesian answers, we're in the lap of the people who don't understand the frequentless answers. And then, yeah. So I think we have to go down this route.
Anybody like to disagree?
There was a point lurking at the beginning of what you said. You were implying that in many cases the prior distribution is in fact rather precise, rather narrow.
Oh, sorry, talk to me.
Yes.
The prior distribution is rather narrow.
Yeah, you're fairly sure that the effect is not going to be big.
Oh, I see. Well, in terms of, well, you showed the data. I mean, you went right at the beginning, well, then one of the first few slides, most of our product doesn't work. So one thing we know for sure, there's a big lump of prior close to zero.
Yeah. Okay, but now you're in danger of introducing a prior which will outweigh data.
No, because if the prior represents the truth of what we believe, and if it did that, we should stop. We should, all the pharmaceutical industry should close down. But that's clearly not the case, because there are products out there that are going to work. So we are going to have a big lump, I think we should have a big lump of prior either on zero or very close to zero, and there's papers by Spiegelhalter back in the early 90s, I think, who talk about this and even go further back. But if the likelihood is sufficiently far away from that, it just evaporates.
But also, I think what that says is that your experiment has got to be big enough that your likelihood will be tight enough to shift that prior.
Yes, correct.
Strong though it be.
Correct.
So that tells you that the fact that prior was strong tells you something about how you've got to design your experiment.
Absolutely.
But actually, one of the key things about priors such as you just described, not so much how much prior you put near zero, but how little or not quite so little you put in other places.
So that is a problem, because it's set, you can't just put a flat prior everywhere else,
exactly.
Because you end up with Lindley's paradox. So you have
your
need.
Prior is bound to be informative, to some extent, because all prior is informative, what everybody says.
Well, so flat prior is ridiculously informative in favour of the drug, because it's saying you can go.
Depends what it's and what parameter it's on. I mean, it's in favour of having an enormous effect if you're
exactly.
On the axis, like probability one and in fact bigger than a good or sort of thing.
Absolutely, which is.
That's not a. It's an improper prior, it's not a real prior.
No.
All priors are informative.
Mm. Absolutely.
But the prior such as you describe, what matters is not how much lump is in the middle near zero, it's how much the tiny little bit out here slopes, potentially.
Well, it's. I think both of them have an influence.
But just having a lump near zero.
So you do need to elicit that other piece.
Yeah.
The other comment actually that's just been put before, I think it might be your opinion, is I spoke about correct priors. Those in the literature that argue what the expert believes is what the expert believes. We just need to know that what we've elicited is what they believe. But what they believe is what they believe. But if in 3 years' time, or whenever the experiment ends, or 20 years' time, someone else has done it, turns out that actually theta was somewhere else, that shouldn't be a criticism of the individual expert opinion at the time, as long as we've elicited it correctly. So it's the definition or the assumption of what correct means.
I was talking about correct in the sense of trying to improve this attrition problem. And if you're trying to make sure you're only taking forward drugs which are likely to work, if you start with an optimistic prior, you're likely to have the same attrition problem as you are with people using frequentist methods who've got predisposition to put forward the drug that they're all attached to.
Okay.
So you have the same long-term problem to overcome.
Certainly, yes. If you're always listing optimistic or observing optimistic ones, one might check whether those are the right experts to be asking to design your drug development.
I want to mention something that I heard Stephen Sen say. I'm not quite sure what he meant by it, but I'm pretty sure it's relevant. That you can have uniform priors perhaps for the effects that you're trying to detect, as I've suggested you should, the effect of the drug that you're trying to detect. But he said for the nuisance parameters, you cannot, uniform priors won't work. You'll end up setting the variance to infinity, I think, was the point of view if you try to...
That's what I was just trying to recall, yes. I did remember reading that fairly recently. I think
he says it's an improper prior that when you work in that paradigm. I can't remember whether he actually offered any other... No, actually, what was it? I have a feeling, maybe I could actually respond to you outside of this, but actually I felt at the time reading that that wouldn't be an issue in the drug development paradigm. You know, if you like, it was a theoretical property, but I think my conclusion from reading that was...
I'll tell you, I'm probably going to get fired for recounting this, but I'll tell you a case where I think it is an issue in the drug development paradigm. If you're trying to use historical data to reduce the size of current trials, and you know you have to downweight them and discount them because your historical data are not fully relevant, and all the thinking and talking and reading that I've done about it suggests that if you try to be neutral about how much you ought to downweight the historical data and let the data tell you how much it ought to be downweighted, you get nowhere. You have to have a strongish belief about the appropriate degree of downweighting to get anywhere.
So this is using the empirical base, putting...
That's in the data design, is that
well, that would be, yes, the empirical data would be. But the problem is that you've often only got one historical study and one new study, so you're trying to estimate a variance with one degree of freedom.
Right.
Yes.
So therefore you need a stronger prime.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Stephen said. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that would make sense. I think even when we do the meta-analyses to come up with these sort of trials, even if you've got 5 or 6 studies, which is typically a healthy number, you're still in the same boat. You need to have an informative trial on that variance.
And not only on that variance, but in that situation you suspect that there's an offset between that cluster of historical studies and what you're going to do in the future. So you're back to having another level.
But if you think that as well, if you think that, yeah. Fix the question while you're doing it.
Come back to me now. I think he also mentioned in that paper about crossovers and using tests.
And crossovers came into it as well.
And it ends up reducing to a parallel group study. And I was thinking, well, why would I do this anyway? And so I think that's perhaps why I was able to dismiss that, or thinking that in my case it wouldn't be a scenario that panned out. But yes, I mean, there may be others where it does.
But it seems to me that Bayesian things almost fall into two categories. One way, the uniform prior is fine. The Bayesian is just a help to thinking about it, and perhaps to formalising what you're going to do with the expert opinion anyway. And the other group, where you'd love to be able to go Bayesian, but you can't find an appropriate prior.
Specialists in the therapeutic area, but then you've also got a lot of data anyway, haven't you? Do you give all the data that you've got on a compound to the expert and then they assimilate that with their medical knowledge to get the client?
I certainly see people advocating that approach, and I think one then could do like a systematic review and say, you know, is each of the experts aware of the literature after this systematic review? Plus something else, maybe.
In drug development, the literature that's out there will be your drug information.
Yeah, so that systematic review could be published, it could be part internal, and it could be some experiments that have never been written up anywhere, or a previous organisation, or something else that's brought in. I think that's perhaps what I was trying to do, and you tell me whether successful or not, but with this sort of final slide of, you know, I think we are doing many of these things already. I'm just advocating that there may be a place, and particularly in early development, here, where I'm just saying that I believe that adding this extra component of the subjective elicitation, but yes, one may have a whole load of data or other parts, either from the systemic or literature or other parts. Perhaps just to that question that I put about the number of published studies, and you're using subjective informative priors. I mean, people, I mean, is it surprised by only 20? You know, do you think it's in the thousands and it might have missed some? What's...
Well, Fazel's a
certain place. Across, I think, I can't remember exactly how someone described it, but something like the 40 found in drug development in clinical trial literature.
If you're including phase two, I think I might have expected more than that long one.
Yeah. So, although I haven't finished my systematic review, I started with someone's paper, I thought, well, if someone has done the systematic review and full search criteria are in that paper, then looking at those 40, which of those you've subjected and performed with priors, comes down to around about 20. And then, of course, I picked up a few elsewhere. But, you know, it's not 5,000 papers that I've got.
I think there's another reason why this methodology hasn't caught on so much yet. The one time that I've come across it, I was actually suggesting to a group who were thinking about a trial that they consider elicitation to try and get some information. Mm-hmm. And they just considered there wasn't enough time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's an extra stage to tack on. In an area where they weren't expecting to have to spend more time.
Yeah.
I mean, they know there's lots and lots of things to be done afterwards, and to add this extra stage on is puts them off going through a process when you've got a protocol. If you could do it properly, I agree, this idea of having a protocol for it's a very good one, making more transparent.
Yeah.
But it's another whole stage to add into the process.
I guess that's one of the points that I'd like to go and describe in this writer about the feasibility of it. But yes, it's okay to get people working on a hypothetical experiment in one UK site, but what about the feasibility when you label a global drug development programme and you need to get 15 experts, both internal and external? How feasible is that? And even if anyway they were in one site, actually getting them together on a particular day. So, yes, there's a validity, there's also the feasibility. But if we're serious, you know, these are molecules that are failing at 50% rate at the moment. Maybe it's a price that, well, some of the molecules we have to pay.
It would be interesting to know from the journal's point of view what their attitude is, and you know whether they've been approaches have been turned down, or whether they're just viewed with extreme caution, or that they're just not submitted to the journal to start with because people are frightened. They're not being
frightened. They won't be. Yeah. So I don't have an answer. I don't know if anybody else does have an answer. I'd be interested. Well, in fact, actually, before I chip in, but does anybody have an answer about journals?
I just think in terms of time, preparing a paper for a phase two study that isn't going to show an awful lot of patients there, so not a lot of information in terms of pushing the drug forward. You know, pharmaceutical companies spend the time preparing papers and putting it. Then already all the teams are already moving on to phase three, but the most interesting thing about it is the design of the study, which isn't necessarily going to win over people that pay our wages at the end of the day. So.
I don't know, any other views about the journals and reason why they might not appear? There certainly are guidances available for what one should publish in the Bayesian. I'm blanking on there, but there's Steve has published some, I should know the name, but there's some acronym that talks about what makes a good Bayesian report. But these are how to report, whereas the Shelf and other things are about how to set up the elicitation. But you know, maybe if you're using the things like Shelf or Samantha Lachoy's work, plus Steve Goodman's that isn't going to increase the chance of it being published.
I don't have any experience of it, but my guess is that it wouldn't, you know, a reviewer wouldn't jib at the idea of a perhaps if it was entirely Bayesian, they wouldn't like it, but a Bayesian sort of add-on, I wouldn't have thought would go amiss. And also that it could be quite easy to do if you just take conjugate normal distributions and say, here's my frequentist confidence interval, and by the way, if I put in a prior that looks like this, it turns into that, and if I put in a prior, a more sceptical prior, it turns into that. You know, one paragraph, why not? If the reviewers want to cut it out, so be it, but I suspect they would let it stand.
Yeah, I think if you presented it in that sort of way, if this, then that is the implication. If that, then that is the implication. But just to sling in an elicited prior that one happens to have, first of all, perhaps many reviewers would be a bit delicate about accepting it as having validity unless there was some extra backing supplied. And I think secondly also the authors would be very cautious about sending it in the first place. So the authors are shy about doing it, and for that reason the reviewers have little experience of getting it, and you're building up, as you say.
When you put it like that, the legal department might have more view on it than the
researchers. I'm aware the clock is sort of ticking past, perhaps the after that. I don't know whether you feel there's more time or...
Well, we're going well, and Sue, is there any deadline for us?
I don't know, we've gone past.
Right. No, we're not good for that. That's excellent.
Have you circulated the attendance?
Sorry?
Did you circulate the attendance sheet?
Attendance sheet?
Yes, I sent it. I sent it off. I don't know what
happened. Excellent. No, all of them back. It's all a bit quick.
Just a comment on the elicitation. I mean, this is largely for internal decision making to a company, and. So we may have a deliberate strategy to publish fairly bland, easy palatable results, and we're using this for how we make internal decisions. So that could be one thing why that we don't get so much published. And I've got sort of two views. I suppose as somebody who works for Pfizer, I see this as a competitive advantage. So if other companies are not interested, great. But then as a patient who's getting old and may need drugs, I'd wish we'd all use it as well. So I have sort of mixed views on it.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for the question. I haven't put my email on it, but it's nelson.kimmersley@roche.com if you want to follow it up, and I'll provide the slides to Peter so they'll get uploaded. But thank you very much for your interesting questions. Thank you.